Imagine it's fall, 1903. You're a construction worker for the city of St. Louis. For the last week, you've been tasked with widening the far western end of Manchester Road. It's an unremarkable stretch of packed dirt, several miles outside of the city limits. There's not much out here, just a few farmhouses and shanties. The job's been long and arduous, and the rains yesterday nearly flooded the whole area. But at least it's quieter than working downtown. You put your shovel down and call out to the rest of the crew.
All right, that's lunch.
But before you can sit down to your own lunch, some of your men leap to their feet, dropping their pails. One of them gestures for you to turn around. You turn to see an old man holding a shotgun, pointing right at you. Now, you boys are trespassing. This is my land. You hold your hands up, trying to keep calm. Sir, we mean no disturbance here. We're from the city. We're widening Manchester Road for the Olympics.
The what?
The Olympic Games. First in the country, right here in St. Louis. The old man points his gun east. Then I think you boys must be lost. St. Louis is that-a-way. This here is private property.
Sir, I don't doubt it's your land, but see, technically this road belongs to the city, and it's going to be used for the marathon. It's 25 miles long, so I guess they needed some more running space.
The old man ponders this.
Running space? I don't give a darn what you use it for. But if you're going to dig up my fields to widen your road, we should talk about compensation.
Well, I don't know nothing about that.
But you like sports? Like running, track and field? You let us keep digging, and I'll put in a word with my bosses about getting you some tickets. How's that sound?
With a slow nod, the old man lowers his shotgun. You allow yourself to exhale and extend your hand.
Can we shake on it? Deal?
The old man hesitates, then takes your hand in a surprisingly firm grip.
Make sure they're good seats.
Oh, don't worry, Hoff. I'll try and get you the best seats in the house. And, yeah, think about it. Next year, your property will have a front row view of the marathon race. Maybe you can even sell your own tickets.
The old man cocks an eyebrow at this, and satisfied, he shuffles off. You and your crew go back to your lunches. You wonder how many more times you'll have this conversation before you're done widening this lonely stretch of road. You just hope you can make good on your promise to get that old codger his tickets. Otherwise, when the marathon runners come through here, they might also find a shotgun pointed in their faces. American History Tellers is sponsored by Audible. I like puzzles. I like adventure. I like clever people. I like things on the edge, which means I love mysteries. The perfect combination of storytelling, mental challenge, and often murder, like in the Penguin modern classic, Perfume, The Story of a Murderer by Patrick Susskind. And as an Audible member, I can choose one title every month to keep forever from the entire catalog of classics, bestsellers, new releases, and Audible originals, ready to listen whenever, wherever, on the Audible app. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/tellers or text tellers to 500-500. That's audible.com/tellers or text tellers to 500-500. American History Tellers is sponsored by Audible. Listen to a new bold take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Ilan Ishkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. A chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion, now more relevant than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother. From Wondery, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is American History Tellers. Our history, your story. As the spring of 1904 approached, the city of St. Louis stepped up its preparations for the World's Fair and the first Olympics ever held on American soil. The two combined events would bring more people to St. Louis than the city had ever seen, and excitement was reaching a fever pitch. The St. Louis Olympics would see triumphant performances across several different sporting events, but the Games would also face problems, including harsh weather, low attendance, and a lack of international athletes.
But for Olympic hopefuls, the Games still represented an opportunity to excel on the field and maybe even win medals and set records. For some, it would also be their first chance to get out of their small communities to see a big city. This would be especially true for a group of Native American women who would put their own spin on the brand new sport of basketball. This is Episode 2. Let the Games Begin. With the World's Fair and the Olympics quickly approaching, the city of St. Louis hurried to finish construction in time. David Francis, president of the fair, had already delayed the fair's opening by a whole year so it could be held at the same time as the Olympics. But there was still a mountain of projects left to finish if the city was to be ready for the crowds and athletes. The World's Fair, by far the more popular event of the two, would open first, followed a month later by the Olympic Games. Throughout the spring of 1904, new athletic complexes rose around the campus of Washington University. First was a castle-like building called the Physical Culture Gymnasium, made of limestone and red granite. Next was Olympic Stadium, a 19,000-seat concrete grandstand encircling a running track one-third of a mile long. And in addition to the university dorms, extra accommodations would need to be constructed to house the athletes. Next door to the university campus, a 1,200-acre stretch of Forest Park had been cleared for the fairground site. The River de Pere was rerouted. New water, gas, and sewer lines were built throughout the park. Construction was completed on the massive exhibition palaces, all painted white and built only to last the 7-month duration of the fair. When all was said and done, the work would cost investors over $20 million. David Francis and exposition officials planned a World's Fair with several themes, but the main ones were westward expansion and American global power. As a result of the recent Spanish-American War, the United States had acquired new lands and protectorates in the Caribbean and Pacific. The fair aimed to showcase these foreign locales while always keeping American imperial might front and center. The World's Fair, officially known as the Louisiana Purchase Exposition, opened its gates on April 30, 1904. The day was bright and cloudless. David Francis stood on a bandstand among senators and dignitaries. Simultaneously, in Washington, D.C., President Teddy Roosevelt pressed a golden telegraph key that sent a message to St. Louis to officially set the fair in motion. Attendance, as expected, was staggering. In the first month, more than 1 million people passed through the gates. Once inside, these crowds encountered a vast temporary city sprawling across the rolling hills of Forest Park. Fairgoers wandered through broad avenues, past gardens, waterways, and pavilions built by state and foreign governments. Although the setting was meant to enhance the educational aspect of the fair, the practical effect was both dazzling and overwhelming. The fair was so huge that it was estimated a viewer would need 20 separate visits to take in the whole spectacle. For much of the 19th and early 20th centuries, World's Fairs were popular places to see the newest, costliest, and most technologically advanced items of the time. But no one had seen a fair this elaborate. Crowds gawked at 40-horsepower automobiles, a new medical device called the X-ray, and perhaps most astounding of all, rows and rows of outdoor electric lighting. But one person who saw none of this was Olympic founder Pierre de Coubertin. After the contentious transfer of the Olympic Games to St. Louis from its original site in Chicago, Coubertin had withdrawn his involvement entirely. The third Olympics would go ahead without the support of its creator. With Coubertin out of the picture, the International Olympic Committee passed all organizational control of the Games to the Amateur Athletic Union, the largest sporting regulatory body in America. This meant the St. Louis Olympics was now run by the man who had complained the most bitterly about Coubertin's leadership, AAU head James Sullivan. Sullivan was a former track and field star before becoming an athletic promoter, and he made no secret of his dislike for the Games or their founder. But now that the Games were his to command, he embraced them as an opportunity to promote the AAU and himself. In a spring 1904 interview, he assured St. Louis newspaper readers, "It is the intention of the World's Fair to make amateur sports a prominent feature of its exposition. The Olympian Games, of course, will be the principal feature, including teams from many countries." What Sullivan didn't say to the interviewer was that the list of many countries was dwindling. Just months before the Games started, the Russo-Japanese War broke out when Japanese ships attacked a Russian naval base. Travel through the Pacific Ocean became too dangerous for passenger vessels. And later, Great Britain announced that in solidarity with Japan, it would not be sending any athletes. Soon, France and several other European countries followed Britain's lead, leaving only a handful of countries fielding Olympic teams. But for the remaining countries sending athletes, as the summer drew near, one by one, participants began to arrive. Imagine it's May 1904. You're a 33-year-old Irish athlete, just off the train. You've never traveled this far from home before. Now you've gotten lost in the winding, maze-like streets of the World's Fair. The sun is setting, and all the barkers shouting for your attention are starting to wear on you.
You, sir, 40 different brands of ketchup. Care for a sample?
Oh, thanks. You're also in a serious dilemma. After a 3-day journey, you've arrived to find there was no room at the hotel where you were scheduled to stay. An athletic club in New York had promised to make arrangements on your behalf, but didn't follow through. And with fair visitors filling every other hotel in town, there's no place for you to stay.
Quickly now, see him now before he goes. Beautiful Jim Key, the educated horse.
In addition to the barkers, you wander past hundreds of men reenacting a South African battle, a grand lagoon spotted with gondolas, and a long, snaking line to get a photograph made by a Kodak camera. Finally, you stop to ask a stranger for directions. He's about your age and appears to be covered in grime and soot that, on closer inspection, turns out to be grease paint. He kindly walks you through how to get back to the Olympic Stadium.
And then you turn right, and you're right there.
But hey, what's that accent? You're Irish, right?
Yeah, indeed I am, from Tipperary. I knew it. I know my accents. I'm an actor, and I play a British guy every day, right over there at the Boer War reenactment.
Well, yes, but there's a big difference between the British and the Irish.
Tell me about it. My wife's Irish. She gave me hell for playing a Brit, but then I told her I was getting $35 a week.
What are you doing here?
I'm competing in the all-around, 10 track and field events at once.
Oh my goodness, that's incredible.
All I'm good for around here is dying. 3 times a day I charge up that hill, and 3 times a day I get shot.
But winning the gold for your country? That's something to be proud of.
Yeah, it's not my country. At the Olympic registration, they told me I had to be British or nothing. Ireland doesn't count, apparently, because we're not an independent country.
They should talk to my wife. She'd have something to say about that.
But hey, yeah, where are you staying? You should talk to my wife. She'd love to talk to an Irishman.
Well, I don't know. The hotel I was supposed to stay at is full up.
Oh, that's terrible.
No, you come stay with us. At least until you find other accommodations.
Well, that's very kind. Thank you.
No, you're welcome. And who knows? If it doesn't work out with the Olympics, maybe you can come get a job with me and get shot at every day.
My shift just ended, so yeah, let's go now.
You fall in step behind him. At this moment, lodgings of any kind would do, but spending dinner with this man and his Irish wife seems like it might lift your spirits. Tomorrow, you'll return to the stadium and find out where you'll be training to compete for Great Britain. Irishman Tom Kiley was one of the few foreign athletes to make the journey to St. Louis. An accomplished track and field champion, he turned down offers to represent the United Kingdom, which his native Ireland was still part of, because Keeley wanted to compete for Ireland alone. Doing so would mean that he'd have to pay his own way across the Atlantic, as Ireland didn't field an Olympic team. Upon his arrival in New York City, Keeley was greeted with newspaper articles lauding his exploits and offers from half a dozen American athletic clubs to help pay his expenses. But when he reached St. Louis, he got a cooler reception. The man who identified himself as Tom Keeley from Ireland and Tipperary was told that he would have to compete as a British athlete, whether he liked it or not. Keeley was just one of nearly 700 athletes making the journey to the Olympic competitions. Of that total, the vast majority didn't travel far. 525 were American and 41 were Canadian. Barely more than 100 athletes came from other countries. But Olympic hopefuls were only a quarter of the athletes who converged upon St. Louis that summer. Various non-Olympic contests were hosted by Sullivan's Amateur Athletic Union, including YMCA and university-level championships in several sports. According to the International Olympic Committee, an Olympic event was open only to amateurs and had to include foreign participants. But since the games were folded into the broader athletic program of the World's Fair, those rules were often bent or outright broken. This made little difference to the average spectator, for whom the distinctions between Olympic contests and an AAU event were nearly invisible. Even among the athletes themselves, it was sometimes unclear which events were and weren't part of the Olympics. But one thing remained consistent. Everyone had to pay a $2 general entrance fee to compete, with additional 50 cents charged per event. Despite the confusion, the competition still meant something to the athletes and the crowds. Olympic medals held prestige, and the thrill of competing on a big stage was enticing. As the first months of summer drew near, more and more athletes assembled in St. Louis, eager for their chance to enter the record books and compete for the gold. American History Tellers is sponsored by NetSuite. Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, switch to NetSuite, the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR, all into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you'll reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud, no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite this year. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/tellers. That's netsuite.com/tellers. netsuite.com/tellers. American History Tellers is sponsored by Field of Greens. I turned 50 this past February, and at milestones like these, you start to make promises. This is the year I get healthy, you might say, or the year I pay attention to what I eat. Because even if you're turning just 30, you're not the same spring chicken you were. And turning 40? Well, that's when you really start to notice. So at 50, I'm definitely paying more attention to my body. Exercising, eating well, and finding ways to improve my health that are actually things I can accomplish. Field of Greens is one of those. It's literally one scoop a day, packed with organic fruit and vegetables to support heart and vital organ health. My first shipment is arriving this week, and it'll become part of my morning routine. Maybe it should be part of yours. Field of Greens offers a 100% money-back guarantee, so it's a no-risk, easy step towards better nutrition. Plus, I've got you 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Just visit fieldofgreens.com and use promo code AHT. That's promo code AHT at fieldofgreens.com. fieldofgreens.com. On May 14, 1904, the first American Olympics kicked off with an uncharacteristically cool afternoon to a crowd of several thousand. Organizers had hoped that President Teddy Roosevelt would oversee the opening ceremony, but the president had refused the invitation, feeling it improper to attend a public event of such scale during an election year. As a marching band played, a parade of 75 athletes entered the field and took up positions along the sidelines. Nearby stood Olympics director James Sullivan, who handed the starting gun to Exposition President David Francis. Francis fired the gun enthusiastically into the air, setting the third Olympic Games in motion. Actual Olympic events wouldn't start for another month and a half, but many spectators stayed to spend the afternoon watching Missouri high schoolers compete in their district track and field championships. It was a humble opening ceremony, even by the standards of the time. But another feature of the St. Louis Olympics would be rather grand. For the first time, winning athletes would receive a gold medal. At previous Olympics, only silver and bronze medals had been awarded, if they were medals at all. Winners had also received olive branches, laurel leaves, cups, and trophies. So the first opportunity to win a gold medal came in St. Louis on July 1st with a gymnastics competition. Held in the open air of the Olympic Stadium, competitions were twofold. The first were artistic gymnastics. Athletes performed three routines on parallel bars, horizontal bar, and pommel horse. Routines were scored by judges and tallied to determine the winners. The second portion included three track and field events, long jump, shot put, and 100-yard dash. St. Louis newspapers speculated that German and Austrian athletes had the greatest advantage in these events because the German tradition of Turnverein had come to define how modern gymnastics were practiced all over the world. The newspapers were partly right. 30-year-old Julius Lenhardt was Austrian by birth, but had been working in a factory in Philadelphia for the past year. Competing for his local athletic club, Lenhardt performed well enough on the artistic routines to overcome his poor showing in the track and field events and won gymnastics gold. But it was German-American gymnast George Iser who made the biggest impression. Iser worked as a bookkeeper for a construction company in St. Louis and was a member of the local German-speaking athletic club. A world-class gymnast, he had finished second in the combined exercises and first in horizontal bars, parallel bars, and the rope climb. All told, he won 6 medals, 3 of them gold. And he did it all with a wooden prosthetic left leg. Grouped with gymnastics, the next competition required endurance as well as speed and strength. The all-around was 10 different events combined, a forerunner of the modern-day decathlon. The event included a 100-yard dash, shot put, high jump, hurdles, pole vault, long jump, hammer throw, and a 1-mile run. Contestants could medal in each individual event, but also accrued points toward the all-around medal as they went along. It was expected to be a battle between the Irish champion Tom Kiley and 2 U.S. athletes, Ellery Clark and Adam Gunn. Clark, who had been ill during most of his stay in St. Louis, fell behind early. It rained continuously, and water had flooded some parts of the track. After 4 events, Gunn led the field, and Kiley was in 5th place. But by the 8th round, Kiley had pulled ahead in the weight throws and held on to win. Still, much to Keeley's frustration, the record keepers refused to honor him as a representative of Ireland, and instead gave his gold medal to Great Britain. This was despite the fact that officially there was no British Olympic team. In solidarity with their ally Japan, which sat out the Olympics because of war, Britain refused to send a single athlete overseas. But even though international travel had proven difficult, a handful of athletes from Asia would still make their way across the ocean. Some of them focused only on sports, but others found that athletics could be a gateway to other accomplishments. Imagine it's July 1904, a hot Sunday afternoon in St. Louis. You're an athletics trainer and assistant coach from the University of Pennsylvania. Standing in the shade of the gymnasium wall near Olympic Stadium, your focus is on a young man finishing the last of his set on the dirt tennis courts. He's getting ready for his Olympic event later this summer. He's a 21-year-old from Japan named Shunzo Takaki. He's quick with his feet and wooden racket. You've watched him play 2 opponents today, and he's made mincemeat out of both of them. You're here from Pennsylvania to scout promising young athletes for the university, and you've had an eye out for Takaki even before you made the journey west. As he's coming off the court, you invite him over to talk in the shade.
Hello. That was quite a set you just played.
Thank you.
It would have been better if I hadn't let it go to deuce just then.
You shouldn't be so hard on yourself. Your one-handed backhand is remarkable. The young man shrugs as he wipes the sweat off his face with a towel.
It's just how I learned how to play. I didn't realize there was anything unique about it until I arrived here in St. Louis.
Well, now that you are in St. Louis, what's next for you? U.S. National Championships? Wimbledon?
Takaki simply shakes his head. I just need to think about the next match, not anyone's after.
That's probably good, but I like to think about the future myself. And on behalf of the University of Pennsylvania, I'd like you to think about your future too, with a place on our tennis team. This doesn't include tuition, but I can assure you that you'll get a first-class American education, the kind that opens doors and helps you climb the ladder in American society. Shunzo cocks his head and smiles. That's the purpose of a university education in this country, isn't it? Improving one's station in life.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And nothing will improve your station more than a degree from Penn, believe me.
Well, good.
I want a job, steady income. More than I can make playing tennis or baseball. Wait, you play baseball too?
You didn't know that? You don't have that written down in your scouting report?
Yeah, you gotta forgive me, but I didn't even know you had baseball in Japan.
Yes, we have baseball. I play second base and outfield. I also play football. Maybe I can play those sports at Penn too.
Maybe, yeah, but I'd have to see you in action first. But if you're as good with a bat and a pigskin as you are with a racket, I'm sure we can arrange something.
The young man extends his hand.
All I want is a good education and to stay here in America. If your university can give me that, I'll play all the sports you want.
You smile and shake on it. He's got a strong grip, not that you'd expect anything less.
You try to hide your surprise as the two of you make your way inside the gym. You've met plenty of American athletes who, like Shunzo, will say that they can't see further than the next tournament. And it's been your experience that they can't. But this Takaki fellow clearly has a plan for where he wants to go in life. You hope you'll be able to help him turn his athletic ability into a new life for him here in America. Japan began adopting European and American-style sports after opening to the West in 1853. At 21 years old, Shunzo Tataki was already playing championship-level tennis in Japan, but he also excelled at baseball, gymnastics, and American football. He came to America to try out for the Olympics just before the outbreak of the Russo-Japanese War. And after playing in some exhibition tennis matches in St. Louis, Tataki enrolled at the University of Pennsylvania and went on to set records in several sports while earning his degree in economics. His tennis matches, specifically against arch-rival Harvard, would generate headlines while he continued to excel at baseball and football. Tataki eventually left sports behind for a career as a silk importer. Gregarious and always good for a quote, he continued to appear in society pages well into the 1930s. But for unknown reasons, Tataki didn't compete in any official Olympic tennis matches. Instead, the gold medal was taken home by Beals Wright, a 23-year-old Harvard grad. Dwight Davis, Wright's fellow Harvard student and sometimes double partner, was an even bigger tennis star. He already had the first international American tennis competition named after him, the Davis Cup. But 1904 wasn't Davis's year. The 24-year-old was knocked out of the Olympic singles competition in the second round. Bicycling was one of the most popular recreational sports of the day, and competitive cycling featured seven different events. American Marcus Hurley seemed the odds-on favorite to scoop up most of the medals. Still, the 20-year-old cyclist had his doubts when he discovered the conditions of the stadium's racing track. The weather had been scorching hot, and he would later describe the course as a track of cinders, dry and very dusty. During the 5-mile event, Hurley was knocked out of the competition by the recklessly riding Nash McCree. Named Crash McCree in the sporting press, the 17-year-old American cyclist was known less for his victories and more for the terrible accidents he would cause on the racetrack. An article from Bicycling World suggested that McCree does not seem to be a vicious rider, but simply rides all over the track. Hurley went on to win gold in 4 other events, a record that stood for nearly 80 years. The New York cyclist's performance would be even more remarkable in hindsight, as there was very little rest for riders between each event. Throughout all Olympic competitions, if a spectator happened to glance away from the playing fields, he might have seen a determined young woman on the sidelines, wearing a large hat and carrying an enormous wooden tripod. Her name was Jessie Tarbox Beals. She had picked up photography as a teenage hobby after she won a camera in a contest for selling magazine subscriptions. At the age of 30, she walked away from a career as a teacher in Buffalo, New York, to focus on photography full-time. It was a Buffalo Daily newspaper that assigned Beals to cover the World's Fair and the Olympics. Carrying a 50-pound camera that shot 8x10-inch plates, she took pride in her physical strength, as well as her ability to sweet-talk just about anyone into posing for a photo. Taking notes as she shot, Beals would take photographs, and reporters would follow up with her subjects later for interviews. These stories and Beals' unique photos ran simultaneously in the newspapers of multiple cities for the entire 7-month run of the fair. Beals surely noticed that she was one of very few women to take the field in any capacity during the Olympics. But in a short time, Beals and many others would come to know about a team of high school girls who traveled from far across the country to compete. Hailing from a Native American boarding school in western Montana, they would make a splash at the World's Fair with a brand new American sport called basketball. But off the court, they would face their toughest opponent, racism.
American History Tellers is sponsored by the podcast Expedition Unknown. Did you know that there's proof that Robin Hood might have been a real person, even using secret underground passageways to rob the rich, or that gold coins discovered in Florida may be connected to a Spanish treasure fleet? On the Expedition Unknown podcast from Discovery, host Josh Gates travels the world to investigate these and more of history's greatest unsolved mysteries. He'll take you looking for art stolen by the Nazis, exploring mysterious caves in Nepal, and deciphering giant geoglyphs drawn into the earth in Peru. Travel the globe with Josh Gates as he investigates some of humanity's greatest feats and most iconic legends. Listen to Expedition Unknown wherever you get your podcasts. American History Tellers is sponsored by ZBiotics. Last week, I went to a big podcast conference with tons of meetings and a lot of happy hours, so the nights were late and the drinks were many. Sometimes you need to choose between a fun evening and a good morning. Or maybe not, if I had just remembered to pack my ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink, the world's first genetically engineered probiotic. Invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking, it creates an enzyme that breaks down a toxic byproduct produced in the gut when you drink alcohol. It's this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for your rough next day. You just need to remember to make Z-Biotics your first drink of the night, drink responsibly, and you'll feel your best tomorrow. I wish I did. Vacations, weddings, birthdays, and reunions, there's so much going on, so get the most out of your spring plans by stocking up on pre-alcohol now. Go to zbiotics.com/tellers to get 15% off your first order when you use tellers at checkout. Zbiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee, so if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. Remember to head to zbiotics.com/tellers and use the code TELLERS at checkout for 15% off.
Just over a decade before the St. Louis Olympic Games, a physical education instructor at a Springfield, Massachusetts YMCA invented the game of basketball. James Naismith developed a game involving a soccer ball and two peach baskets to keep his students occupied indoors during the long winter. Promoted by YMCAs across the country, the game spread like wildfire. As the men's game expanded, a woman's version of the game emerged, featuring modified rules to discourage roughness. In Montana, women's basketball caught the attention of Josephine Langley, a member of the Blackfeet tribe and an assistant instructor at the Fort Shaw Indian Boarding School. Fort Shaw was part of a government program of off-reservation boarding schools that forcibly assimilated Native children into white culture. These schools were designed to educate and improve Indian children, but also stripped them of their language and customs. They were taught English and a variety of vocational subjects intended to make them contributing members of white Western society. But many students at these schools clung to their native traditions however they could, often at risk of severe punishment. For Langley, a former Fort Shaw student herself who started teaching there upon graduation, the game of basketball offered a way to harken back to tribal traditions in a way that would escape the notice of Fort Shaw's white schoolmasters. Basketball's style of play reminded her of a Blackfoot game her grandmother had played, called double ball. Since she and her students weren't allowed to play double ball, basketball presented itself as the next best thing. So Langley formed a team and found no shortage of interested players. For many of them, as for her, basketball came naturally. Girls from many different tribal backgrounds joined the team and practiced as often as they could, refining their shooting, passing, and dribbling. And after finding the women's rules too slow and dull, Langley started coaching them in the men's rules instead. They were dedicated and played hard. A new school superintendent, Fred Campbell, immediately saw the girls' team as an opportunity to build a unique kind of athletics program, one that could give them an opportunity to compete against other schools and introduce the girls to a wider world. Imagine it's October 1902. Outside, the Montana fall has brought a freezing chill to the whole town. But here inside the gymnasium, you're sweating. You're 16 years old, a member of the Shoshone tribe, and a student at the Fort Shaw Indian School. Classes have finished for the day, so now you and your teammates have gathered here for basketball practice. Miss Langley, a teacher at the school, claps her hands and runs everyone through a series of drills.
Keep the passes coming. Keep them coming. Keep them. That's good. That's good.
The game of basketball is still pretty new to you, as is having a female coach. What isn't new to you is that your tribe has played these kinds of cooperative games for a long time. You take a shot, but it ricochets off the side of the basket.
That was a good shot, but keep your knees bent. It'll help.
I'm keeping them bent. It's a basket that's not cooperating. Even though you haven't been playing long, you rarely miss a shot like that. You have an innate talent for the game. Miss Langley says that's why she always pushes you a little harder than the others.
Just see the ball into the air, and then right down into the basket. Visualize it. See it. An easy arc.
You try to do as your coach says. And this time, the ball rattles into the basket. You hustle over to the pulley that drops them bottom out, catching the ball in midair. Just then, your teammate Emma dashes up beside you. She's from the Chippewa Cree tribe, a year older than you.
Hey, have you heard? We just got invited to play a game in Butte. Butte? It's 100 miles away.
I know. They're calling it a travel game. And if we win, we get to play more at other schools.
Out of the corner of your eye, you see Miss Langley approaching. She has a strict rule against talking on the court, so you quickly turn away from Emma and let loose with a one-handed shot. The ball lands squarely in the basket.
That was a good shot, but I think you two were talking. It's okay. Did Emma tell you the news?
Yes, ma'am.
But why are we playing a game so far away?
Because we want people to see how good you are. We're going to be playing a lot of travel games from now on. Now get back to center court. As you practice your dribbling, your breath is quick. Your shoulders heave from the exertion, but you feel great. You can't wait to play basketball against other schools. More importantly, you can't wait to beat them.
The Fort Shaw girls team had no shortage of talent, but Minnie Burton quickly became their star player. She was from an Idaho Shoshone tribe, and at first declined to join the team, wanting to focus on her studies. But after some encouragement from Coach Langley, the tall, agile teenager was soon at every practice. There were no other teams nearby, so the Fort Shaw girls started to travel, playing out-of-town games against schools in Butte, Missoula, and Bozeman. Everywhere they went, they made short work of the competition. They became so popular during the 1903 school year that their home games were held in the nearby town of Great Falls, which had the area's only gymnasium big enough to hold over 200 fans. And after the 1903 season came to an end, Superintendent Campbell told the girls that next summer, the Fort Shaw team would be traveling to St. Louis. They had been invited to live at the Model Indian School on the grounds of the World's Fair. The school would be a living exhibition of its own, where different tribal school children would go to class in the mornings and perform demonstrations in the afternoon. These would include weaving, poetry, music recitals, and basketball. If all went well, Superintendent Campbell would push for the team's inclusion in a women's basketball championship. The young players were thrilled at the prospect of traveling to St. Louis and attending the World's Fair, but many bristled at the idea of being put on display for white viewers. Still, the opportunity to play basketball on such a big stage was too good to pass up. In June of 1904, the team boarded a train for St. Louis. The Model Indian School, where the Fort Shaw girls would live, was just one exhibition of its kind dotting the World's Fairgrounds. Some 1,400 native and indigenous people from around the world were put on display at what the fair billed as living exhibitions, nothing more than human zoos, which made spectacle and entertainment of non-white so-called primitive cultures and their customs, cuisine, dress, and religion. White viewers paid to gawk at the Innu people of Japan, or the Tehuelche from South America. The conquest of indigenous people was a theme baked into the fair itself. Officially called the Louisiana Purchase Exposition, the entire event served as a centennial commemoration of the massive land deal with France, which paved the way for American expansion. That expansion, though, had come at the expense of the Native American nations of Western North America, who spent much of the 19th century battling the U.S. military and being forced onto reservations. Now, as part of the World's Fair, hundreds of members of those tribes were performing in Wild West shows, working concessions, or reenacting battles with U.S. soldiers. For 5 cents, fair spectators could even have their picture taken with the famous Apache chief Geronimo. Olympic coordinator James Sullivan had also come up with his own way to exploit Native peoples for entertainment purposes. He put together a 2-day Olympic exhibition called Anthropology Days, which sought to combine the scientific discipline of anthropology with sporting entertainment. But Anthropology Days were neither entertaining nor scientific. Held over 2 days in August, indigenous people drawn from the living exhibitions, given no training and few instructions, competed against each other in both European-style sports and so-called savage-friendly games that were in many cases figments of Sullivan's racist imagination. Participants were asked to perform feats like tree climbing and mud throwing. And in the more traditional Olympic events like the high jump, shot put, and 100-yard dash, many of the native athletes either didn't understand the rules or refused to follow them. Runners in the 100-yard dash stopped just short of the finish line to wait for their teammates, or ducked under the tape rather than breaking it. Sullivan had presumed that all native peoples used spears, so he was perplexed when many of them performed poorly in the javelin toss. Other native contestants, offended by being made a spectacle, simply refused to participate at all. And as for the anthropology part of the events, the collision of cultures only served to support Sullivan's notion of white European superiority. He wrote testily in his final report that his native subjects failed in teamwork and cooperation because they simply weren't smart enough to perform. There were other problems with Sullivan's Olympics. Over the course of the summer, scorching heat and heavy rains tested athletes and drove away spectators. Attendance plummeted. But Sullivan hoped that one upcoming event might redeem his troubled Olympics, the marathon. A track and field man himself, Sullivan had hyped the marathon as the ultimate test of athletic endurance. And after the failure of his Anthropology Days exhibit, he also hoped the marathon would be another chance to conduct yet more physical experiments on athletes of all races. Meanwhile, though not officially part of the Olympics, the Fort Shaw girls performed like Olympians at outdoor and indoor basketball exhibitions, defeating every team that challenged them. And as the basketball championships approached, Minnie Burton and her teammates knew they had what it took to win it all. The only question was whether a team of Native American girls from a remote corner of Montana would be given a fair chance to compete. On the next episode of American History Tellers, the Fort Shaw basketball team takes the World's Fair by storm. American athletes continue to distinguish themselves in the Olympic Games, and the marathon proves to be a bizarre, one-of-a-kind sporting event full of twists and turns. From Wondery, this is episode 2 of the St. Louis Olympics for American History Tellers. I also have two other podcasts you might like, American Scandal and Business Movers. For more information on the early Olympics, we recommend America's First Olympics by George R. Matthews. American History Tellers is hosted, edited, and produced by me, Lindsey Graham, for Airship. Audio editing by Molly Bach. Sound design by Derek Behrens. Music by Lindsey Graham. This episode is written by George Ducker, edited by Dorian Marina. Our senior producer is Andy Herman. Our executive producers are Jenny Lauer Beckman and Marshall Louie for Wondery.
I'm Trey Wingo.
And I'm Kevin Frazier. We're teaming up on a new weekly sports podcast from Wondery, Alternate Routes.
As former SportsCenter anchors and current sports obsessives, we're consumed by all the what-if questions that make being a sports fan so excruciatingly fun.
If you're like us, then you also live and die on the fallout from every drop pass, busted draft pick, and game-changing play.
Or play call.
Intercepted at the goal line by Malcolm Butler.
Sorry, Marshawn, still too soon. Each week on Alternate Routes, we'll take a flashpoint in sports, break down what actually happened, then explore every alternate scenario and the ripple effects it would have caused.
Follow and listen to Alternate Routes on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
I mean, the possibilities are limitless, Kevin.
What if Portland drafted Michael Jordan?
What if the NBA never vetoed the Chris Paul trade to the Lakers?
That's a butterfly effect for real.